From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 2000 election, George W. Bush pointed to privatization as the fix for Social Security in America. Then the stock market went under, privatization became a four-letter word, and the war on terror swept Social Security reform off the national agenda. But the Social Security crisis didn't just go away. So what's it going to take from each of us to fix it? In this hour, the coming battle over Social Security reform. But first tonight, the latest from Minnesota's Senate race. Walter Mondale officially stepped back into American politics last night. Minnesota Democrats unanimously approved the former vice president as fill-in candidate for the late Paul Wellstone. With less than a week to go before Election Day, the 74-year-old Mondale dove directly into the contest with former St. Paul Mayor Republican Norm Coleman. I spoke with Bill Wareham, political editor at Minnesota Public Radio. I asked him how the Mondale-Coleman contest is kicking off.
Well, it's different than certainly we would have expected had the senator lived. It's a little more somber. There's a lot more chaos, I think it would be fair to say. The Mondale campaign hit the ground today after last night's official party nomination to have the former senator and vice president replace Senator Wellstone on the ballot. Mondale made some radio station stops around the Twin Cities. I think he's got an ad up on the airwaves. I think behind the scenes they've been working on this since shortly after the plane went down Friday. I don't know if you're aware that Senator Wellstone's sons actually went to Mr. Mondale and asked him to replace their father. So even though he hasn't said anything about the campaign until last night, I think there has been some behind-the-scenes work going on to make sure that he was ready to do this 5 or 6 day campaign here.
And now there's really no choice but to rush. It's really one long weekend that will decide it all. Bill, how public a figure has Walter Mondale been in Minnesota since he left the vice presidency? And in his last campaign for the presidency, Minnesota was the only state he won. Has he remained high profile, or has he been busy with his law work and more or less out of sight?
I would say he's maintained a moderate profile. I think he came back here and people have been aware that Mr. Mondale and his wife are pillars of the community, I guess. He is probably one of the more high-profile things he has done is host and lend his name to a public affairs series put on by the University of Minnesota. So he's had his name out there. He has been on some corporate boards. He has worked for a local law firm, largely to bring in business for them. So he's had maintained a base level of presence. He didn't come out of nowhere this week.
And Republican Norm Coleman, who made his name as St. Paul mayor, didn't take much time coming out pointing effectively at Walter Mondale's age. He's 74 now. I've got a little clip here of a speech that Norm Coleman gave last night.
These are times in our state where, you know, you got to choose the right path. And the choice is so clear. And it's so clear. You can either move into the future or you can get stuck in the past.
Did Norm Coleman make points with that, Bill Wareham, pointing at Walter Mondale's age effectively?
You know, I think we're going to have to wait till Tuesday to actually find that out. And it's really hard to tell right now. I think it's not only the candidates who have to figure out how to respond to this short campaign, but the public. And one thing you have to remember is that there are a lot of people of voting age in Minnesota who aren't familiar with Walter Mondale as a representative of this state. And while I did say he's maintained some base level of visibility, I have heard especially some younger people say, you know, boy, he's 74 years old.
Who is this guy?
Yeah.
Mondale came out himself this morning and took that head on, saying that his age and experience were an asset. Let's listen to a bit of that.
I don't apologize for my experience. I think the very things that our country needs right now in that Senate are the things that my experience permits me to bring to bear. Secondly, while the dates may be different, the fundamental problems and the challenges for the American people remain the same. We've got a serious economy. We've got international security challenges. And that's what this campaign is about.
Bill Wareham, is Walter Mondale seen as an effective candidate for taking on the mantle of Paul Wellstone, one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Senate, or is he actually seen as a greater moderate, and does that help him or hurt him in Minnesota?
Well, I think Mr. Mondale may have a little bit of both. I think that in terms of his political views, he can justifiably lay claim to the Wellstone legacy. Their views on issue after issue, whether it be how to approach a war with Iraq or tax policy or whatever, Wellstone and Mondale are very close on the issues. But on the other hand, he does have this image of being an elder, more moderate statesman who isn't going to go out of his way to offend his colleagues on the other side of the aisle or the White House. So he may get a little bit of both things actually working for him.
And I'm sure you've been tracking this race even before Senator Wellstone's untimely death. What issues have been working for Norm Coleman? What issues are likely to work for Walter Mondale?
Well, Norm Coleman is going out right now and telling people that in addition to this message of him being more youthful and vigorous, on the issues, what he's been talking a lot about are tax policy. He will go to Washington and be a voice for keeping a lid on taxes, mm-hmm. and that's the way to grow jobs. We've been hearing a lot of that in the last day. And the two things that Mr. Mondale seemed to key in on today were potential war with Iraq and his being in favor of getting our allies and the United Nations on board mm-hmm. with that, and Social Security policy. He made a point of saying he does not favor any kind of privatization of the Social Security system.
It's all happened so fast. Are there any polls out already on the contest between these two men?
Well, there was a poll by the Minneapolis Star Tribune that showed Mr. Mondale ahead of Mr. Coleman. On the other hand, I'm not sure how confident I am in that poll. Unlike most polls that are done over several days, it was done quickly in one night.
And if there's ever been a situation where the only poll that really counts is the Election Day poll, this is it. Minnesotans have been through so much turmoil in the last week, they may not know what they think themselves yet.
Yeah, I think people are just still shaking their heads over the events that have occurred since last Friday.
We'll be watching closely. Bill Wareham, thanks for joining us.
Certainly.
Bill Wareham is political editor at Minnesota Public Radio. He spoke with us earlier from St. Paul. On the eve of the midterm election, debate over a looming crisis that will dog America for 50 years or more is stuck in soundbite limbo. Social Security is in trouble so deep that no one wants to really talk about it. Tonight, we will. Here's what we're looking at, folks. Reduced benefits and increased payroll taxes, delayed retirement, and maybe a flyer on the stock market. In 6 years, the first wave of baby boomers begins to receive its checks, and the piggy bank is empty. What are you willing to sacrifice to save Social Security? Do our politicians have what it takes to fix the system? And will we let them? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from San Francisco is Robert Posen, visiting professor at Harvard Law School and former vice chairman of Fidelity Investments. He was a member of President Bush's Commission to Strengthen Social Security. His article in the November issue of Harvard Business Review is Arm Yourself for the Coming Battle Over Social Security. Good evening and welcome, Robert Posen.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Robert Posen, I want to look first at the scale and dimensions of the problem here. You say in your article in the Harvard Business Review, and this is talking to businessmen who will be very attuned to this on a day when Mr. Fastow is indicted on 78 counts, you say that the government's handling of the so-called Social Security surplus would send private sector executives to jail for fraud, that it makes the Enron debacle looks like peanuts. What's wrong with all the talk about a Social Security surplus?
We're talking about a Social Security surplus when we're looking at it only on a year-to-year basis. We're looking at the amount that comes in one particular year and the amount that goes out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at last year, you could say that there was a surplus of $190 billion. However, any company that has a pension plan would never look at a long-term pension plan on a year-to-year basis. Instead, what you look at is the accrued liabilities and projected liabilities over the next so many years. You look at the assets you have and the projected assets, and you compare them. And if you do that for the United States over the next 75 years, you look at what are the projected liabilities and what are the projected assets, you see that we actually have a deficit of somewhere in the $3.2 trillion number. So for us to say that there's a $190 billion surplus when actually we have a long-term deficit of $3.2 trillion is just very bad accounting, and that bad accounting masks the problem, leads to the illusion that we really can wait for a long time. And unfortunately, it is an incentive for people not to do anything.
Quote President Bush's budget director Mitch Daniels telling the Wall Street Journal last year that the fiscal 2003 plan could have a tiny $1 billion surplus. But again, that's folding in Social Security. You say in the private sector, there's no way you'd be doing that.
Well, every year there's been a Social Security surplus for the last few years. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is in the budget process, basically, Congress winds up spending it most of the time.
On the track we're on, I'm sorry, Robert Posen, but on the track we're on, when does Social Security actually go insolvent, and what does insolvency mean?
Social Security goes insolvent sometime around 2040 by the projections of the Social Security actuary. And what insolvent means is legally, without a change in the law, Social Security would not be able to pay benefits.
So the checks would not go out. But 2040 sounds so distant that it makes it sound like not a problem.
Well, that's exactly the challenge that we have, because this is the sort of problem that if we wait to 2040, then we would have approximately in 2040 a 28% cut in benefits, or alternatively, the payroll tax, which is now 12.4%, would go up to about 19%.
You write now, that in the year...
In the year 2040. Mm-hmm. Now, those are very draconian measures. So in order to prevent us from having to put into place these very draconian measures, we should start soon, and we can put in modest measures and over a period of time be able to address this problem in a reasonable manner.
You write that in 2017, the so-called surplus will turn into a deficit. And you say that 15 years before then we'll begin to feel the economic impact. Well, 15 years before then is now.
Well, that's correct, because what we're doing now is that surplus, when we get to about 2007, starts to get smaller and smaller, and by the time we get to 2017, it becomes negative. And when Congress goes to pass tax legislation, there's a 10-year window in which you have to look at the tax revenues and the tax expenditures. And in the past, we've always had this cushion, or for years we've had this cushion of Social Security as a surplus, and we're going to start to lose that. In fact, we're going to start to have a Social Security deficit on a year-to-year basis, which we're going to have to deal with.
Jack Beatty, why are Americans' politicians dancing around this? Why don't we hear more about it, even now at the climax of a political campaign season?
Well, it's reputed to be the, quote, third rail of American politics, and politicians are just averse to even talking about it. In one Pennsylvania race now, a Republican who in the 80s, I think in the early 80s, recommended reducing the cost of living allowance slightly in Social Security, he's being attacked by his Democratic opponent as if he were as if that were just right now. Mm-hmm. So he said something 20 years ago, and it's such a live issue that he's being demagogued on it right now. You know, the Republicans, for their part, have made a kind of switch in they're not talking about privatization. In fact, they sent out a memo. Don't use that word. Call it personal accounts. Well, whatever you call it, it's still privatization. But they're not even calling it that. The Democrats, for their part, are not even, are just saying, you want to privatize, but they're not addressing the problem to which privatization is one putative solution. In fact, one Democratic ad really, I think, is the gong for all ads this year. It shows President Bush pushing a woman in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs.
And yet, we've got to talk about it. We've got to fix it. We're talking tonight about America's Social Security scandal, about the looming crisis that American politics is ducking. What are you ready to do to fix Social Security? Raise taxes? Reduce benefits? Retire later? Put some of that money in the stock market. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
from Boston.
This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's social security scandal, about the politics that American politics, the crisis that American politics is ducking. Why don't American politicians step up and deal with this gigantic problem? And do we have the maturity as a nation to fix a problem of the future today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Robert Posen. He's visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of Arm Yourself for the Coming Battle Over Social Security in the November issue of Harvard Business Review. He's a former vice chairman of Fidelity Investments, and we'll talk about that. But Robert Posen, first, you say that it's going to take probably all three, smaller benefits, higher taxes, and some kind of investment in markets to set this thing straight. But before we get into that, talk to us about the consequences of this Social Security squeeze, which is going to be there in greater or lesser measure, depending on when we get on top of it. How will we begin to feel its impact in the coming years, even before we get near insolvency?
Well, we'll feel it in a number of ways. We have a set of tax cuts that the Bush administration implemented, but those sunset in roughly 2010. So around 2010, we'll have to make decisions about extending or not extending those tax cuts, and we'll have to look 10 years in the future, and then by that time, Social Security will be on a year-to-year basis.
Meaning huge pressure to reverse those tax cuts that may come even sooner than 2010.
Well, they'll be in a negative fact. And then as you go out further, we're going to have to start redeeming the bonds. Congress will start having to redeem the bonds that are now held in the Social Security Trust Fund, and it will have to either reduce other appropriations or we'll have to increase our external debt. And so you'll start
to see higher interest rates.
You'll have if you have a lot of more Treasury debt, then you'll have higher interest rates. If you have to have Social Security competing against education or health or welfare, then you'll see some very nasty budget fights.
So it becomes it becomes a drag on the entire economy and begins to push out other priorities in the budget.
Correct. It competes against other worthy priorities if we let this go on and on.
So how do you see us addressing it? I mean, our time is short and there's a lot to talk about, but you say we've got to do all three, reduce benefits, raise payroll taxes one way or another, and maybe tiptoe some of this money into markets where it's going to get a higher return.
Yeah. As to the first, we have to put some more money into the Social Security Trust Fund. And I examined the article a number of different ways to do that. And my preferred way is to increase the maximum payroll base against which Social Security taxes are assessed. Right now, Social Security taxes at 12.4% are assessed only up to $85,000. My suggestion is that we have some lower level of Social Security taxes, like we have in Medicare, which are about 3%, 2.9% to be exact, to have those assessed above the $85,000.
Up to what level?
Well, you know, I suggest a variety of different approaches, but if you did it, we modeled it, you can go up to $150,000 or you can go all the way up. The way we handle Medicare is essentially there is no ceiling.
In other words, high income earners would keep paying that Social Security out of their weekly or monthly paychecks right on up. It wouldn't stop somewhere mid-year.
Yeah, but on the other hand, they would pay over $85,000 at a much lower rate than 12.4% because they're really not getting very much Social Security benefits above that amount.
You point out that Social Security payroll taxes are among the most regressive taxes that Americans face.
They are. For something like 60 or 70% of Americans, they pay more in payroll taxes than they do in income taxes. So I think that the idea of raising the base, raising the maximum, but putting it at a different and lower rate makes sense.
What about benefits?
Benefits are slated to grow. There's no suggestion in the article that we reduce the current level. The question is, how much are we going to let them grow? And the basic problem we have here is demographic. As more and more people live longer, yet we're not producing as many people, we have a different support ratio, meaning the number of workers versus the number of retirees. In 1960, we had about 6 workers for every retiree. By the year 2030, we'll have about 2 workers for every retiree.
That's going to be a very heavy load on those younger workers.
Right. And now that people live longer, that's a good thing. But one of my suggestions is that we look at something called longevity indexing, which is a fancy way of saying is as people live longer, their total lifetime benefit should stay the same, which means that their monthly benefit can't grow as much as it's slated to grow.
Does this mean then that American elders will at some point be relatively less well off compared to the circumstances on Social Security today?
Well, they will be better off than they are today, but they will not be as well off as some projected benefit schedule in 2050.
Better off in constant dollar terms?
Yeah, better off in constant dollar terms than we are today in 2001. But what happens is all these benefits are slated to grow, and so that by the year 2050, those benefits will be substantially higher than they are now.
I guess
now,
I'm asking, as you would change it, how much would it be? Would that growth be slowed, and would that leave elders relatively less off than today?
Yes, they would still. I would slow down the growth of benefits, but they still would be better off in constant dollars than they are today. They just would be a little. They would not get as large a growth as they would that is under the system that's currently scheduled, which we can't possibly afford.
And the last
piece is a very crucial distinction.
Mm-hmm. And the last piece is what's been called privatization.
The last piece is not privatization in my article. The last piece is looking at various ways to raise the return on Social Security.
Well, doesn't it amount to the same thing?
No, it doesn't, because you can raise the return by having the government invest in the market. You can have a personal account. You can do it in a variety of different ways. This is not privatizing the system in the sense that now there is, you know, a private account and it's no longer a government Social Security program. This is either through government investing or through personal investing, increasing the return that's in your Social Security account.
But we're talking about the same thing, getting that capital out into the market where a higher return might be possible.
We're talking about getting it into the market. It may not necessarily be the stock market. It could be inflation-protected bonds. I personally believe that if we're going to increase the payroll tax base and we're going to slow down the growth of benefit, we have to politically provide some, icing, some sugar. And for many people, we see surveys that say they would like to have some ability to invest in the market. But we have to do that in a very diversified way and in a very administratively low-cost way so that we don't produce another Enron. In my article, I suggest that we use these very broadly diversified index funds and that we use something like half bonds and half diversified stock funds so that we reduce the risk as much as possible.
Robert Posen, stand by. Jack Beatty, there's the doctor's prescription from Robert Posen, and it's got all three elements that people don't want to hear about, but there they are.
Yeah, there they are. It's good for him for coming out for a tax increase and benefit cuts. The trouble is his article and Model 3 of the Bush Commission report, of which his article is a close approximation, differing in the tax increase, has the same problem. The problem is that the plan would lose more in diverted revenue from the individual accounts than it would gain by the benefit reductions and the tax increase. It would the gap between what we are now, you say you're going to divert 3% of your payroll tax to this individual account. Well, the gap that creates in current funding of Social Security over 10 years would be $1 trillion. Question is, how do you pay in order to make the transition from the current system of pay-as-you-go to the system of privatization? How do you pay? Where do you get that $1 trillion over 10 years?
Excuse me, Jack.
Robert Posen, what's the response?
This is very This is significantly different than Model 3 because there is a tax increase. And
I understand,
had the Social Security actuaries score this, and they show that instead of the cash flow surplus going negative, as under the current system in 2016, actually the cash flow doesn't go negative until 2020. And instead of the system going insolvent in 2038, under my proposal with a tax increase of the base as well as benefits slowdown, in 2038, the lines actually cross and the system breaks even.
Representative Posen, so, I want to ask you in very simple terms. Well, if you take money out to put into a private – one second, Jack. If you take money out to put into a private market, who makes up that money in terms of paying for current Social Security recipients? Where does it come from?
Okay, there is some short-term borrowing involved.
How much?
When you take the money, you can see it's in the realm of 500 to 600 billion. But the fact is, when people are allowed under this proposal to take 3% out of their Social Security, they have to accept a lower level of traditional benefit, and the objective is to have the lower traditional benefit plus the personal account roughly approximate what they would have gotten. So that it's a timing problem. Yes, the money is taken out now, but later on when they come to get their traditional benefits, they're going to get less traditional benefit because they're also going to get what's in their personal account.
Robert Posen, if you would stand by, I want to welcome into our conversation Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Congressman Frank.
Thank you.
We're talking about Social Security night tonight and how and when Congress will step up and act on it. What's your sense of when we can move beyond rhetoric and really get into solving this problem?
Probably when you have a decisive majority one way or the other in Congress. What you have are divisions. You have the Republican Party, which was inclined to be supportive of some form of partial privatizing, although you're not allowed to say that anymore. They used to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
That is allowing some percentage to be diverted from the Social Security Trust Fund into private stock accounts. That turns out to be very unpopular with a lot of people, so the Republicans have temporarily abandoned it. There are some intellectually honest people, like Mr. Posen, who advocated it and are still there, but they've been abandoned perhaps temporarily by the Republicans. And so what you now have is a kind of a standoff as to what direction you go in, and I think it will probably require there to be in Congress and in the White House a president with a supportive majority in Congress one way or the other.
Which we could have as early as next week.
What?
Which we could have, hypothetically, as early as next week.
Yes, I think the Republicans haven't wanted to say this, but if the if you get George Bush and a significant Republican Congress, if they take back the Senate and hold the House, then they may move in this direction. The Democrats, we disagree very much with these ideas and would not want to do that. But
how much real room for maneuver is there, Barney Frank? How different could a real solution from the Democratic side be?
Well, I think Mr. Posen starts that. I read his article,
mm-hmm.
which is a very intellectually honest presentation of a case that most of the Republicans agree with but are lying about, frankly, temporarily because they got sort of beat up over it. But he begins his argument by saying, look, the tax cut of 2001 is in danger. And he makes a very persuasive argument that it's very important if you want to be able to preserve the large tax cut that George Bush got Congress to put through, that you do something like this, because otherwise people will be looking to that tax cut in part to shore up the revenues that are involved there, to shore up Social Security. He also then goes on to say that if businesses want additional tax reductions, once again, they've got to do something like what he says, because otherwise they will be in this situation where people say, well, you shouldn't be cutting taxes for corporations. You'll be taking money away that we can use for Social Security. Mm.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. Barney Frank is laying this at the feet of the Republicans. Is that fair?
Laying what at the feet of the Republicans?
Well, he's saying Republicans are lying about where they're headed.
Well, that's been I mentioned earlier that I think they sent a memo around saying do not talk about privatization because the whole climate had changed relative to that.
And the Democrats' role here?
Right. We're now at 8. Let me just say we're now at 8 dirty words instead of 7. Privatization has become one that you can't mention.
Right.
I guess the point is, Jack, is it fair to lay the ducking of the problem at the feet of Republicans alone?
No, I wouldn't lay it at the feet of Republicans alone. No.
Oh, by the way, you're misstating me. I say that there are two very different views. I didn't say the Republicans are ducking the problem. I think they're dissembling about what their solution is. I think Professor Posen, Ms. Posen, is much more honest than the Republican politicians. They're temporarily moving aside. The Democrats would be for undoing part of that very large tax cut from 2001. Ms. Posen says, look, to the and that's the lead argument in his article is, hey, our tax cut is in danger, and further business-oriented tax cuts will be in danger unless we find some way to deal with this. So I think both parties have got fairly strong views here. The Republicans have found theirs to be unpopular, and they're temporarily ducking, but I think they plan to come back if they get control.
Robert Posen, Barney Frank is suggesting that Democrats would not get into what's called privatization. Can anybody really avoid it?
I think that there are a lot of Democrats that would not want to have personal accounts. But I think that if Democrats were honest, they would say, let's do something with the payroll tax, such as what I suggested, which is raising the base, which Congressman Frank may agree with.
Oh, I agree. Second of all,
they would have to address the benefit issue. Everyone knows that the benefits are growing in a way that we can't quite finance, so we'd have to do something to slow down that. And we see some Democrats who are saying, I don't like personal accounts, but maybe we should try putting some portion of the Social Security Trust Fund in bonds. Maybe we should try putting a little in stock, get a little better return. So I think that Democrats could come up with a solution that uses all three approaches, but in a quite different way than Republicans.
Yeah, and
for me, that's okay.
Barney Frank?
There's a qualitative difference, and Professor Posen deals with this very honestly in his report. One argument has been Bill Clinton had talked about putting some of Social Security Trust Fund funds into the stock market. Now, I think Professor Posen suggests that would get a lower return. He cited the New Zealand example. But a number of Democrats have been in favor of trying to increase the return to the Social Security Trust Fund, but for the Trust Fund as a whole, or for the Social Security Fund as a whole, rather than individually. The other thing I would say is I do agree with him about raising the base on which you tax, but I disagree with Mr. Posen. He suggests in his paper that we increase the amount that's subject to Social Security taxation, but that above the current, I guess, $85,000, mm-hmm. The tax be only about a third of what it is for the first amount. I think mm-hmm. that's kind of reverse progressivity, where you tax the first $85,000 at a 12.9% rate.
So you'd keep the full bite as it went up.
Yeah, I mean, why would you reduce the rate by two-thirds on upper incomes? I think that's just
the reason. The reason is because the way the benefit formula works, any amount above about $70,000, every dollar contributed, you get very, very little in the way of benefits.
I agree, but I would think, implicitly, it seemed to me, maybe a little explicitly, were skeptical about the notion that this has no element of welfare, that it's purely a payback what you put in. I don't think it is that. I don't think it should be that. And I do think that I think raising the tax rate is a good idea. Raising the base is a good idea, but I don't think it's justifiable to maintain the myth that this is purely a contributory return system.
No, I think it's
Barney Frank, Robert Posen. We've got to take a break, and Congressman Frank, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for coming on tonight. And he's off to his legislation. We're talking tonight about America's Social Security crisis. It's looming. It's there. Are you ready to stand up and help fix it, to raise taxes, reduce benefits, retire later, put some of that money in the stock market? Can we have a reasonable conversation about Social Security, an honest conversation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's Social Security scandal, about the crisis that Washington is ducking, and maybe some of us are in our hearts as well. Why don't American politicians step up and deal with this gigantic problem? Do you hear political candidates speaking candidly about Social Security in this campaign in your hometown? And when will we deal with the Social Security crisis? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Robert Posen. He's a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of a new article in the November issue of Harvard Business Review, Arm Yourself in the Coming Battle Over Social Security. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Patty's calling from Jefferson, Wisconsin. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment is pretty straightforward. I think I'm one of many people who doesn't believe that Social Security is going to be there when we retire, and frankly don't expect it to be.
Isn't that kind of sad, Patty?
I think it's a concept that time has passed.
Really?
I think that we have a need to support people with lower income, and we need to deal with that in a different way. But other people, my thought is, give me the right to put more than 15% of my income in my 401k, and I'll take care of myself.
So you're saying you expect to be relatively well off. You don't expect to need Social Security, put out a kind of welfare system for the elderly poor, and let everybody else fend for themselves?
Well, I think we have to take some responsibility. I earn an income. It is my responsibility to budget for my family and my family's well-being long term. And I don't believe that the government has any wherewithal to take care of me, nor do I think that any payment of Social Security that I've seen projected would be valuable to my family, you know?
We hear you loud and clear, Patty. Hang on. Jack Beattie, I want to invite you in here. You know when Social Security came, and here you hear the voice of Patty, and I think I hear another generation giggling in her arms there, and she says, hey, I don't think I'm going to need it. It's hardly worth counting on.
Well, I don't agree. I don't, the program will be there. I just don't think there's any question about that. She doesn't have to worry about the program disappearing. The question will be the size of her benefit.
Well, she's not saying she's worried, Robert Posen. Here's a caller saying, I don't think it's going to be worth counting on, and maybe it's, and she's saying it's time has passed anyway. Is this a psychological surrender, or is Patty right?
I think we see a tremendous split between people roughly under 40 and over 40. And lots of people under 40 have very little confidence that Social Security will be there at all. And they're looking at these same numbers that I'm looking at and thinking, well, they just can't count on it, and they're going to go and try to do the best they can themselves. And it's a good idea for them to do the best they can themselves. But we know that there will always be some substantial number, some significant number. We know that, roughly half the elderly now have been are highly dependent on Social Security. So that what we need to do, and one of the things I suggest in the article, is we bring up the floor, the lowest level of wage earner, and help that person through Social Security. We know that in big companies, people have 401ks. We know that higher income people do IRAs. But we know that for lower income people and for lots of people who don't work for big companies, we have very low levels of participations in 401ks. So we can't count on 401ks to solve the problem for everyone. Mm. But we can build a system that gives more support for lower income people, especially those who are not likely to be in 401ks, but then allows for people like Patty to get some modest amount back. Of course, she's not going to feel that it's going to be enough for her to live at the style she wants to. And so smartly, intelligently, she's going to do most of her saving through her 401k, which makes a lot of sense.
Patty, are you still willing to chip in to Social Security, even if you personally wouldn't be in your concept here, be drawing on it later?
I think I've written it off already. You know, it's a situation mm-hmm. where it's become, and people don't admit it, but it's become a welfare system. And so those of us who put in a lot of it are certainly not going to get it back in any type of return that would be considered reasonable. Yeah, even in today's market mm-hmm. where a lot of us are moving things into fixed securities.
Right.
But I'd rather get 3% back on my money than what I'm going to see out of Social Security. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, go ahead and take a piece of it out. Call it welfare and call it what it is. Be reasonable in what you're going to take out, because the fact of the matter is you're not getting a reasonable return on it. And bring it to the people who need it the most, but free up those of us who are being sensible about this to save more effectively.
Well, there's a voice for radical evolution. Patty, thanks for calling. Michael's calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I feel that the whole discussion is a little wrong-headed.
Tell us why.
There's no problem with Social Security. It's a compact between generations, backed by the American government. And therefore, as long as America exists and has an economy, and no one knows what the American economy will be like in 1040, no one knows what medical costs will be like in 1040. In 2040. Mm-hmm. I mean, extrapolating from now, assuming linear programming, you know, it's ridiculous.
I wonder if it really is. Robert Posen, come in, and Michael will bring you back. But Robert Posen, Michael's saying...
Social Security actuaries run three levels of analysis, intermediate, high, intermediate, and low. And they get a range here. So we know that we can't be exactly right. But the demographics, the generation thing that you're talking about, we know where it's moving. We know what the replacement rate is in the United States. We know what longevity is. If anything, we may be erring on being too conservative on longevity. If we have various medical breakthroughs, people are going to live even longer and longer. So that's exactly what's at issue, the intergenerational pact. As we have retirees live longer and longer, and we don't have another baby boom, which seems highly unlikely, we start to have this major financial problem. Now, if we can start to address it now, we won't have an intergenerational crisis. Otherwise, if we let it go on and on, we're going to find more younger people like Patty that just say, this thing is totally worthless and I want to walk away from it.
Michael, we already don't look at it as a pension plan, do we? When people are paying in real time for the elders to have their Social Security checks.
Yeah, but you see, that's right. But you see, it's a matter of political economy. It's not a matter of individual money retirement. I mean, we've had lower taxes because of on the well-to-do, because of the fact that working people were paying into Social Security and the government was using the money from the Social Security fund. That is, in a way, the growth of the 90s was spurred by the excess Social Security balance. Well, things will turn around. We don't know exactly. Of course, the cohorts are known. The demographic stuff is known. But what is not known is the level of the productivity of the economy.
Michael, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Robert Posen, is there any scenario that you can imagine in which the American economy would surge so magnificently that this problem would go away?
Well, you can theorize one, but last year the Social Security actuaries raised the productivity assumptions because they saw that the economy had been more productive, and that actually moved back the insolvency date only 3 years. So that's the level of sensitivity that we're talking about. You're still going to have a problem. When we're projecting things out, that's why I said approximately 2040. Mm-hmm. Before the productivity assumptions were changed, it was 2038. Now it's 2041. But we're talking about that general time period.
Sean's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really think that the funding should come from within government. I think the, for instance, the war on drugs, I think should be eliminated and the money moved over to Social Security.
So you're saying don't raise taxes but move money around?
Exactly. Not only that, but I think taxes should be raised on upper income brackets.
All right, but you don't want to see it across the board. Do you think there's enough money in government, Sean, to cover the kind of numbers that Robert Posen's talking about here?
I really do, especially for the fact that they can't keep going back to the people over and over because we pay enough as it is, I believe.
And yet the people are exactly who receive Social Security dollars ultimately. Robert Posen, is there any scenario in which we can dig deeper into some kind of big government money bucket and pull out a solution?
We can always decide to spend less on defense, less on health, less on education, but I think these are exactly the very difficult conflicts that we would like to avoid. Instead, if we do a combination of these three strategies of putting a little more revenue in, slowing benefit growth a little, getting a little returns, then we don't have to get to the point where we have to ask the very difficult question, should we cut the defense budget? Should we cut the education budget, as this caller is suggesting, in order to fund Social Security? I'd hate to get to the point where we'd have to make those very difficult choices.
And yet to fund your transition, you're going to have to provide money precisely from the kinds of programs he was talking about, from general revenue, to fund the transition and to continue the subsidy that is in your program. So your program calls, it depends on going to general revenue from other, either through tax increases or through cuts in other government programs to pay for the transition from the pay-as-you-go system we have now to the partial privatization system.
If you look at the graphs,
let me finish here. And the whole assumption is somehow that this is going to pay off for the individual person at the end, that we'll be better off with all this. Well, you know, the chief actuaries of Social Security, in a report put out by the Brookings Institute, they do a breakdown of incomes. And this was the real surprise to me. A high earner now, which is $56,000, according to them, is currently scheduled to get $2,168 per month in benefits. Now, under this Model 3, and with a slight variation from Mr. Posen, the mutual benefit cut for everybody at age 62, it would come to $685. That's the benefit cuts for the whole country. The second element would be the annuity. He would get 4.6% return, just as Mr. Posen says. The annuity per month from that would be $1,073, $1,173. That sounds good. But that would have to be cut by $217 for the amount of the penalty on early retirement, and it would have to be cut by $456 a month, because that represents the amount of Social Security contribution that was diverted into the private account. The result is that under current benefits, you get $2,168 under Mr. Posen's plan after all this, with the privatization and with weakening the entire fiscal health of the system by draining billions away, you'd get $1,983.
Yeah. Rubber Posen.
Yeah. Under the current system, we're going to divert $3.2 trillion. Under my proposal, which was scored by the Social Security actuaries, we're only going to divert $0.8 trillion. That's a 75% reduction in the amount of general revenue that we're going to need. So, yes, I do need a little general revenue, roughly $800 billion, to fund my transition, but that's a lot less than $3.2 trillion.
And where does that come from, Robert Posen?
Well, the $800 billion comes from general revenue, just like the $3.2 trillion. The good news is it's 75% less. There's no easy fix here. The other good news is that the combination, even under all those numbers, which are somewhat different under my proposal than under Model 3, you are projected to get roughly the traditional benefit plus the personal account. It roughly comes out to where the schedule benefits would have been. But remember, to get those schedule benefits under the current system with no change, we're going to have to take $3.2 trillion of general revenue, not $0.8 trillion.
I can see we're going to hear a lot more debate about that. What does it cost us to wait on these reforms, Robert Posen? We've only got another minute, but what does it cost every year that we wait?
It costs basically $200 to $300 billion every year. That's the rough number that each year, if we did true accrual accounting, that's the amount by which the unfunded liability goes up. So, and of course, once we get to the year 2010, 2011, then we get the baby boomers retiring, and so it really takes off. And the cardinal rule of Social Security changes that once people are in benefit status, then it's very hard to change it. So what we have to do is to try to do something before 2010, before we get all these baby boomers retiring.
Best guess, what year do you see reform coming through?
I'm hoping to see reform sometime between 2005 and 2008.
Robert Posen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Posen is visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of Arm Yourself for the Coming Battle Over Social Security in the November issue of Harvard Business Review. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by...